Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Silvia Rodriguez Vega. She is the author of Drawing Deportation, Art and Resistance Among Immigrant Children. She is an assistant professor at University of California, Santa Barbara, in the Department of Chicano Studies. She is a community engaged artist and scholar. Her research explores the ways anti-immigration policy impacts the lives of immigrant children through new methodological tools, centering art and creative expression. And Silvia, welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you so much for having me.
Silvia, I really wanted to do this interview because I had never come across the topic of looking at the art of children affected by the brutal policies that were implemented by the Trump administration. I was just floored. And then the policies, when you see the separation of children, it's just so incredibly inhumane. And I just really thought it was important to have this conversation of your work with children in Arizona and California and the role of art in helping them to express their feelings and to have an outlet to tell their story. But I want to start off with you talking about your experiences working with the children in Arizona and California and how it inspired this book.
Thank you so much, Hopeton. Definitely. I started in 2008, which is 15 years ago. And for 15 years, I have not stopped thinking about the kids and specifically about the drawings that I saw. So much so that it has led me to really focus the last 15 years on researching, on writing, on understanding the history of family separation in the U.S. And it all started because I was working with children in Arizona and we were creating a mural. And I asked the kids, what do you want this mural to be about? And a 9-year-old kid said, can we make a mural about peace? And I thought that was a beautiful theme. And I asked, what does peace look like? And he responded, it looks like Sheriff Joe Arpaio shaking hands with a Mexican. And for those who don't know who Sheriff Joe Arpaio is, he was a sheriff for many, many years of Maricopa County in Arizona and became infamous for his immigration raids and for having detained people wear pink undergarments and for conducting very public Southwestern-y trope kind of raids where he would do these media conferences and tell people where he was going to be. And he recruited volunteer sheriff deputies. And it was he called himself America's toughest sheriff. And since then, we've seen various sheriffs and governors come out in these similar ways, very anti-immigrant. And so much so that when Trump was in office, Sheriff Joe Arpaio was the first person he pardoned. And so that gives you information as to what kind of city Arizona became and what kind of Maricopa County, what kind of place it was and what kind of states Arizona was, where anti-immigrant policies were tested and tried there in very horrific ways.
Now, your own personal story, I believe you are an undocumented immigrant that was able to, thanks to the DREAM Act, to take advantage of it. So talk about how your personal experiences in this space informed how your approach to writing this book.
Yeah, so I was undocumented. I arrived to the United States with my family when I was 3 years old. And we were just on the other side of Texas in Chihuahua, which is where we come from. And we moved to Arizona and I lived there. I started kindergarten. All my life, I grew up there. I wanted to go to college, but I realized I was undocumented when I couldn't get a driver's license. I knew we were immigrants, but I didn't know what that really meant in my life until I had to apply for scholarships, travel, things like that. But living in Arizona in a place that was impoverished and marginalized, it was really tough, especially coming from an immigrant family that was undocumented. And so what really brought a lot of perspective into my life and really altered my path was doing art. And I was in a theater group when I was 12, 13 years old. And I never lost sight of how powerful it was for me to understand my own life in through the lens of laws and through the lens of other people's stories. And so when I started working with young people, I came back to art because that was so significant in my life.
There's a counter narrative that I see when you look at the history of the United States, because often people think of the Statue of Liberty and think of this country as accepting of immigrants. And so many of the people that live in this country, their grandparents or great grandparents were actually immigrants to this country. But I think the story that's not told is how the immigration policies have always been biased, discriminatory, and racist.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think children really hold us accountable to that in ways that cannot be mistaken, because they are taught from the time they start going to school that the U.S. is the land of opportunity, the land of freedom, all of these ideas that to them become internalized, but they do not make sense when they're living their lives. And at the same time, they see that their families aren't welcomed. They see that their parents might be detained or deported. And in the book, I argue that this isn't a new thing. Separating children from their families is very American and very much used as a tool to oppress people, to have control of people, to surveil people. And so it's really amazing to see children really tune into that and say, like, wait a minute, at school, I'm learning about respect and kindness and caring, but this country doesn't treat me in these ways that it's supposed to be. And so that really, that creates a way of thinking that I think is an awakening. But I think most people, unfortunately, don't get to have that conversation or that awakening because we haven't acknowledged the ways that we have created family separation since the beginning of the nation. And I think that allows for the continuance of this.
Let's do a deeper dive into the history of separation policies. We can go back to slavery, where children were often sold to other plantations and separated from their parents. We can talk about Native American children being taken away from their parents as we force them into assimilation into other schools. So how do you look at the context of what you see today versus what has happened historically?
Yeah, it's a similar pattern. And as I mentioned, this tool of control, you know, and it's not only enslaved Black children that were sold to white families and used as, you know, commodities, or children who were literally kidnapped from their communities and bused hundreds of miles to places where they had to cut their hair, forget their language, their clothing, their customs. And just a few years ago, we found people found the bodies of many of the children that were in these American Indian schools. And so this is something that is very relevant today. And we see how that has come to be, but it's not the only case. We see Japanese internment camps, families taken away from their communities, often, you know, families separated in throughout the course of that detainment. And so it has been something that continues to happen. There's a scholar named Laura Briggs who wrote a book called Taking Children, and really does a deep dive into the account of separating families from children, from their separating children from their families, and thinks about, you know, the welfare system, also child protective services, and how children are taken from their families when they're Black and brown at higher rates than any other groups and any other families. And so we see that, and then we fast forward to Trump 2018 with the zero tolerance policy, where he and his administration, not only him, but the people that he worked with, literally said that the pain and the suffering were the purpose of the policy. That if people didn't suffer, then the policy wasn't going to work, because it was meant to make people not want to come to the U.S. And so when they saw that babies, toddlers, children of all ages would be separated from their caregivers, then that would make people not want to come. And of course that didn't happen. But what we see is that still in 2023, children are still haven't been reunited with their families from 2018. And although the Biden administration has created an initiative to start uniting families, there were no records kept of what child belonged to what adult. And in fact, many children have been released to the wrong people and even to smugglers and people they shouldn't be with.
I don't want to go off too much topic too much, but I keep thinking about the United States policies and how it interacted with Mexico and Central America and South America and how the situations that many of them find themselves in, which result with in them wanting to immigrate to the United States, in part is due to our brutish, you know, geopolitical policies.
Exactly. I think we as Americans like to think like, why do people want to come here? But what we don't see is U.S. interventions in other countries. We don't see the funding of military folks and the training of them to be able to overthrow governments and create such horrible instability in those countries. It's not just about the violence that exists there or the climate change, what is happening with that, but it's very much U.S. interventions in those countries that have destabilized them so much to the point that they are uninhabitable for their very people, because we forget that people don't want to come to the U.S. People want to remain at home. There's an idea of the right to remain, which means like if they're okay, who would want to leave everything they know, the country, their home, their family members, their communities, their land, to go to a place that is strange and that they may be welcomed in these horrific ways? I think people don't realize that it's not that people want to come, but that they are forced to, and that the alternative to not coming is very much death.
Let's talk about policy. And you write that the pattern of increased deportations began with the end of George W. Bush's presidency. Talk about the formulation of Operation Endgame after the establishment of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, better known as ICE, as a federal law enforcement agency under the U.S. Department of Homeland Security.
Yeah, Operation Endgame, I think, is one of the most unknown policies, but I think it really does give us it was a foreshadowing of what was going to happen. And basically this policy, the goal of it was to deport and remove any deportable immigrant by a certain date deadline. And so that really threw the excuse of the terrorist attack of 9/11, ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, was the response to that situation and the solution, along with the Patriot Act and other policies. But really that meant that surveillance in the country was taken to another level, especially when it came to immigrants. And the hypocrisy is that the people who actually committed this terrorist attack came from the Canadian border, not from the southern Mexico border, but that was the excuse to militarize and fund all of the activities that happened on the southern border, including Operation Endgame, which really created tons of policies and projects where immigration at a national level started to become immigration at a local level in your city, in your state. One of the examples is the policy 287G. Those agreements are, put it simply, it creates local law enforcement becomes immigration enforcement. So there's these PACs or programs that fund local law enforcement to create a database to input anybody who comes in contact with local law enforcement. So if you're a victim of a crime or you get into a car accident and police come and try to help, or you call the police because you need help and they ask you for your driver's license and you don't have one, and you don't have documentation, that's the most immediate way to get on the ICE database. Once you're on that database, you can't become a citizen, you can't fix your papers. And so these are the many ways that immigration law became criminalized, and immigrants became criminalized as well, and has led to what we have now, which is a very much intertwined immigration system with the criminal system, where people now, it is a for-profit business, and people are getting rich off of the detention of immigrants.
Yeah, and I had this down as one of my questions, and I do have the note. If she doesn't cover this in her answer, ask this question. The role the prison industry has played in the disproportionate funding of enforcement over naturalization services. And actually, this goes beyond immigration, just the prison industry complex, which has a profit invested interest in what I would call the over-policing and over-criminalization of life in America.
Definitely. My students are always floored when I tell them that you can go and buy shares in Wall Street from the companies that maintain and run these prisons, and that people are literally making money off of people being detained. And it just blows our mind, I think, as students, as people, as citizens, as members of the society, because it has not been the only time that this has happened. We've already seen how the prison industrial complex has sought to imprison Black men and Black people. And we see that system repeating, thinking now, taking it to immigrants and in detention. And so for every bed that a detention center has, people are making a few hundred dollars. And the goal is to maintain people in those beds for as long as possible, or to make them be deported or self-deport. So to make these conditions of detention so horrid that people would rather kick them, deport themselves, sign their voluntary deportation notes instead of staying and waiting for the legal process to help them or figure something out. And so it is a for-profit business. And I think it's based on people suffering. And it's unfortunately part of this capitalist system that we live in. But it's very much interrelated.
But as I recall from some of the other interviews I've done, it's not just for-profit entities. We also have government-run, local government-run prisons and jails that also take advantage of the revenue they can generate.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think that we don't have a system that really is thinking about the what is going to be best for people. It's thinking about how can I get rich off of people? How can I make money off of them? And if we don't even have to think about adults, we can think about children and how prison beds in are calculated by the reading and literacy levels of third and fourth graders. And so just thinking about a society that rather invests in prisons as a projector for the future, then to think about how can we raise the literacy levels of all children is a society that is already invested in making money off of people. So it is a terrible thing, but I think it's important to talk about it.
Well, I'll talk about the children now. And in the chapter of fear, you write that during my time with children in Arizona, detention and deportation were the most commonly recurrent topics among children of all ages. And there was an image theater exercise that you write about in which students decide to act out Trump building the wall. And Trump building the wall seems to be the most common theme and fear that a lot of these children have. And you talk about an exercise where 11-year-old Paula, playing the role of presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. But talk about that, if you can recall that, acting out this sort of theater type exercise, because I really like the response of the Paula playing presidential candidate Hillary Clinton.
You will have to refresh my memory.
Well, let's just say that she thought a wall should be built around Trump.
Oh, yeah. So to explain to listeners what these exercises were about, so I would ask children, go home, watch the news, listen to the radio, and we'll talk about what was most important to you tomorrow or the next time we meet. And so kids were coming, and during the election, everything on the news was about the candidates and the proposals and the plans. And so Trump was always talking about building a wall and about making Mexico pay for the wall. And so children were obsessed with the wall, not only because it was always on the news, but what it meant for their own lives. And so I said, okay, well, let's make a skit about this. Everybody's talking about it. And so Paula wanted to play the role of Hillary Clinton in response to another kid saying, I'm going to build a wall, and being Trump. And she said, well, you know what? I'm going to build a wall around you and around the White House so that we can keep you, you know, in detained or like away from everybody else. And so I just wrote about how children had really creative ideas of responding to Trump's policies. And that was one of them.
Well, I think it's really important, the work that you did, because I think with exercises like this, when you give children an opportunity to tell their story about the policies that's having a devastating impact on them and their families, we're really preparing them to be politically engaged in the future.
Yeah, it's something that I think families are afraid. Undocumented families are very afraid that their families will be separated. For a child, when you're separated from your parents, it does mean possible death. It does mean you might be hurt. And so, of course, that is the greatest worry. But I also found that parents are afraid to talk to their kids about this, and that they have to often plan a meeting where they're going to tell the kid, hey, if I don't come back, you have to make this plan. And they have to go to a notary and write a letter that says, if I go missing or if I'm detained, my child's custody will temporarily be taken by this other adult. And so they make these plans, and children of all ages have to confront these plans. And what I write about in the book is that this isn't just immigrant families. We know that children in other communities are also adultified too soon because of the risks of living in American society, you know, having families have the talk with children and specifically Black communities of how to interact with police. It's similar to the ways that children of immigrant families have to talk to their parents about, what do I do if I get detained? Who's going to take care of me? What's the plan? And so families are reluctant to have these talks, but unfortunately, they still have to.
In the chapter on resilience, you include a series of pictures created with elementary and middle school students. And the first picture in that group of pictures really caught my attention. It's a drawing by middle school student Daniel, with the background and text being the sentences, freedom is America, followed by, yeah, right. And then a drawing of a man standing on the flag of Mexico, holding a sign that says racist. Talk about the intelligence of these children to really understand what this country and what specifically these policies are all about.
I love that you bring that drawing up, because that is one of the drawings that I think is so powerful. It uses satire. It looks like a political poster. It reminds me of that Uncle Sam, We Want You, like that military recruitment theme poster, where you have a Sheriff Joe Arpaio drawn in a very satirical way with like a huge belly and a tie that has the word Mexicans crossed out, but it also kind of looks a little bit Confederate-like. And he's stomping on the flag, and he has two signs. One says 100% racist, and the other one says Mexicans are not humans. And so this kid does this very brilliant thing of doing writing with huge block letters, freedom is America, in red, white, and blue, super patriotic. And at the same time critiques that idea by saying, yeah, right, in just pencil and as big as those letters. And so this student wrote something about this drawing. And in this explanation of the drawing, he says that Mexicans are treated like animals. So he has these very sophisticated critiques on dehumanization, but then also talks about people that the Sheriff Joe Arpaio will arrest anybody, no matter if they're a US citizen or not, just because they look undocumented, which is something, you know, that goes back to Senate Bill 1070 in Arizona, which was a racial profiling law. And so the student is just so intelligent in putting all of these pieces together in a way that is so convincing. And this is definitely one of the most powerful drawings, I think, in the book.
Do you think the experiences of these children could result in some generational trauma? This is a term I've just sort of recently become aware of how the trauma of one generation could be passed to the next generation.
I think that it's not the drawings. I think that there is already intergenerational trauma. not only because of what I described of the history of the country, but just the history of colonialism. We have people that are native to these lands, as people, especially in Arizona, native communities were literally split in two with the creation of the border. And so there is definitely intergenerational trauma, but what is, I think, within our control is that we are creating more trauma. We're creating stress that becomes toxic, and that toxic stress becomes trauma. And when they don't have an outlet for it or a way of dealing with it or coping and processing it, it can hurt them. It creates physiological changes that alters the way that their brains work. And we know that specifically an area of the brain, the amygdala, is in charge of decision making. And often children struggle with decision making, and it's because their brain is taxed already. They're depleted and they're exhausted and they're always on fight or flight mode. And so it already happens living in inner city communities with, you know, oppression and poverty, and all of these things are compounded. And when you add immigration and Trump and Sheriff Joe Arpaio, it becomes a lot. So what I argue in the book is that art, the process of making art, when you're thinking about these things and processing, that's a way of healing rather than create. It can open up a wound and make you feel very sensitive and raw and emotional and unleash, you know, emotions that aren't pleasant. But at the same time, if you have somebody who is trained to deal with that, I think that it can be very healing for children. And I think that's what I argue in the book, is that we need more art for children who experience traumatic things and who are going through a hard time, which in this society, it's all children.
Interesting when I think about the history of art, the Black arts movement from the 60s and 70s, and there's been a lot of argument about the role of art, you know, whether simply the individual artists doing their personal impact, or at least their personal vision of what they see, how they see the world and what they want to create, as opposed to art being in the service of what I would call, quote unquote, the movement. And I think with your book and bringing, you know, the elementary school children, the middle school children having an opportunity to express themselves with art shows us it's really both.
It is both. I think that the art is really powerful to see, but I think the message that it communicates is so important to hear and to see. And I think often we say we worry about kids and that kids matter, but we don't ask them, we don't talk to them, we don't include them, and we don't involve them in thinking about solutions or movements and things like that. And I feel like the work that I've sought to do is to have children communicate their own stories, their own lived experiences and narratives, through a tool that they understand how to use, which is art. Because I did interview kids. I interviewed their parents and the teachers. And for example, I asked the kid who was drawing a picture and telling us while he was sharing the drawing that his mom got deported, but then the dad had brought the whole family to live in Mexico, and that 3 years he lived in Mexico. That's why his English isn't that good, even though he was born in the US. Then his sister went. So he told this very sophisticated, complicated story. But when I interviewed him 3 months later in the summer, and I said, hey, remember that story you told me about where your mom and you had to go live in Mexico? Tell me about that. How did you feel? And he said, I don't know. And that was it. And every question he was answering with a one-word answer. When he had told me the whole intricate background story through the art making. And so that to me was so powerful in sharing and showing how art is a tool that they can communicate with in more sophisticated ways than verbally.
We've seen a number of states really ban a lot of books in the libraries. We've seen this not just from a state perspective, also from a school board perspective, from a school perspective. And it almost seems like the history that the powers that be feel most uncomfortable with being told is the history that they want to suppress. And even as my daughter in middle school, I would always ask her when she was taking Texas history. I said, okay, do you really want to understand the real reason why Texas wanted to separate from Mexico? Mm-hmm. That, you know, we got this mythical narrative of, you know, remember the Alamo, when we know one of the reasons that Texas wanted to separate from Mexico, because Mexico had banned slavery. And then also when you talk about, I remember reading a book called Manifest Destiny, and it talked about James K. Polk, president, going to war with Mexico on purpose because he couldn't get Mexico to willingly sell what ended up being Arizona, New Mexico, and California to the United States of America. So provoked a war with Mexico. We had the treaty of, what was it, Guadalupe. And then, of course, I shouldn't say, but of course, then we signed a treaty, then we violate a lot of things we agreed to in the treaty. So how important is it to know that our history, and by the way, many countries across the globe have this kind of history, but how important is it for us to understand that history so we don't walk in with, I call this mythical arrogance about freedom and democracy, when our what the country has done is much more complex, some good, some bad.
Yeah, I think this is such an important conversation. And I remember the day that Senate Bill 1070 was signed into law was also the day that a policy HB 2281 was signed, which was the banning of RASA studies, of ethnic studies, in the Tucson Unified School District. And that came along with a ton of books being banned, many books that are included in the book that I wrote. And it was no mistake that the policies that Arizona practiced during that time in terms of immigration spread across the U.S. and eventually to every state once Trump became president. But similarly, this banning of books also spread to the rest of the country. And we're seeing that now in so many places. But I think when we do that, it stops us from holding ourselves accountable to who we are as a country. I think that it creates an imaginary narrative about who the United States is, where it came from, and just upholds a bunch of lies about the history. I think it's incredibly dangerous when you're banning books and not banning guns, which are actually hurting children and schools and families and separating families in horrific ways. And so, yeah, I think that the history that you just mentioned are ways that we are kept from creating community with across racial groups. I think that if we don't have these stories, it stops us from seeing our struggles interconnected from the very beginning of the country till now. And I think that is incredibly unfortunate because children deserve way better. The young people of the country deserve much more. And I think it's just hypocrisy to say that it's patriotic to want to eliminate knowledge and to not know the history of your country. If people were truly patriotic, they would want to know the truth and own up to that truth and move forward in a better way. But we just keep trying to bury it. And eventually, I think it's going to consume us.
Well, I will tell you, your book is so important because hearing the voices of children impacted by these inhumane policies is so important to the discussion about these policies. Sylvia Rodriguez Vega, Drawing Deportation, Art and Resistance Among Immigrant Children. Thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.